Right, we're here on case 2020-1497, the disciplinary counsel versus Eric C. Dieters. Respondent, Mr. Dieters. You'll have to unmute yourself, sir.
Okay, I'm unmuted.
Proceed.
Oh, I apologize. I thought that the Ohio Disciplinary Counsel would go first. I don't have anything to add besides what was in my respondent's brief. I didn't ask for oral argument on this. I would like to say one thing about the context of this. I retired as an Ohio attorney solely because I had reciprocal discipline in Kentucky. And there is a rule that says you cannot work in cases in the firm where you were once you are suspended. The Dr. Durrani cases were so important for me to work on because of my universal knowledge of them, working on them for many, many years. So I actually voluntarily retired my Ohio law license so I can continue to work on the Durrani cases. I have worked on those cases. It's no secret what I do. I draft pleadings for court. I help the cases prepare for trial. I'm immersed in them. Those are 99% of the work that I do. As I'm the office manager here, I prepare pleadings, which I'm allowed to do. I have never one single time since I've retired from Ohio represented myself as an attorney. I am a public figure down here. Everybody knows of my situation. I manage the law office. I've never shown up in court and said, I'm a lawyer. I think the Watkins case is very relevant to my situation. I act as a paralegal. One thing that's very important to know is that I'm a lawyer. I'm always going to be a lawyer. I don't lose the knowledge that I have. And in this Pangallo case, if you look at the rule and you look at the regulation of the unauthorized practices, I pointed out in my very short 8 pages, I don't think I violated it at all. I think everything that I do is done by paralegals every day. It's passing along information. I also want to stress this. I have absolutely no interest. Joe Caligari has always been fair to me. I don't want to be found guilty of the unauthorized practice of law, and I don't want to be fined. I want the court to know that I have absolutely no interest in violating any of these rules at all, none whatsoever. As I point out in my brief, there's a lot of ambiguity. You know, the unauthorized practice of law. You know, I see the unauthorized practice of law is you're practicing law, you're taking fees, you're saying, hey, I'm a lawyer, I'm going to go up. I don't do any of that. Paralegals across the state of Ohio and across this country that work in estates, workers' comp, bankruptcy, personal injury, all day long. In fact, it's a growing theme of paralegal work. You know, they pass along information. They say, hey, you've got to fill out these forms. You filled that out wrong. You need to do that. That's the type of stuff that I do. The Pangallos admit. I mean, I only had one meeting with them, and then I had this email communication. There wasn't one time that I told them that I was a lawyer. In fact, I kept telling them, these people are your lawyers in the office. These people are your lawyers in the office.
Mr. So,
please.
How did your, the loan for $3,000 that you secured for the Pangallos, how did that end up at $10,000?
If I remember correctly, and just to let you know how that happened, Barrister Loan is a company that has lent a lot of money to the Durrani clients. And just for full disclosure, we have no economic interest whatsoever in them because I know that's an issue. So they needed some money for like $3,000. And I think they needed more money. I mean, if I recollect correctly, they just needed some more money. And we said, sure. And Justice, what happened was when they came to us on this case, we thought it was going to be a quick settlement because of the nature of the case. He said he had this serious knee injury, clear liability. Well, what he didn't tell us that he had a prior issue with his knee, and insurance companies always grab a hold of that and fight it. So it was supposed to be a quick settlement. Oh, wait a minute. I apologize. I remember now. So it's supposed to be a quick settlement. these lending companies increase the amount of the loan based upon how long it goes. So I think that's how it ended up being up to $10,000 because they're high interest loans. So you're borrowing $3,000 and you hope it pay it back quick, but then it takes longer. And by the way, this case is still pending. It's never been settled. They went to another lawyer and it's not been settled, but I think that's how it went. I think it was the terms of the loan, Justice, that it inflated. But that I'm willing to answer any questions. I think the court needs to consider some rules and some changes to where it's very specific. Like, you know, you can't do it. Give us all a list, but I don't want to be fined. I'm a good guy. I care very much about our clients. I fight for them every day in the capacity that I'm allowed to, but I, you know.
Mr. Davis, let me ask this question. It brings me to a good point. So that's the, you know, that I fight for them every day. Is that, you know, kind of typical paralegal talk? And in the case with the couple, didn't you assess the value of the case?
Well, I think that sometimes, I mean, I can tell you right now, our staff here at the office are all fully engaged, for example, in the Durrani litigation. It's a crusade. But so I think it is relative to that specific issue about the value, you know, because I'm a lawyer, I know the value of the cases. Mona Eldridge is a paralegal here, works on car accident cases. She knows the value of a case. She comes and reports to the lawyer. She goes, you know, they're willing to take 10,000. They're only offering 15. I mean, Mona's involved in that.
And, well, and the example, let me ask you a question. So without question, you gauge that professional opinion based on having been a practicing lawyer, of course, in your own career.
Yes. Right? Yes.
So do you think that giving someone a value of a legal claim is practicing law?
I do not. And a trial consultants who Mark Modlin is the big trial consultant down here. He gives value of claims all the time. He gets involved in the mediation. So I don't think giving the value of a claim is practicing law. By the way, if it is, I think the court needs to lay down that rule and I'll abide by it.
Well, what about the comment, I fight, you know, you tell your clients, I fight tooth and nail for you. What is that referring to?
Here's what that's referring to. I stay up, I mean, I work incredible hours, and what I do is I research, I draft, I find documents. For example, every time there is a case, there hasn't been a trial in a year because of COVID, but every time there's a case, I'm the one that goes over to the bunker where we keep all the files. I pull out the boxes. I make sure all the exhibits, I read through everything. When I say fight, what I mean is I work my tail off on it. I mean, I'm a workaholic. There's no other way to put it. I live on naps.
So what, so you, we might be kindred spirits. So what you're really saying is you have the legal knowledge to do the research, to assess things, and you do that behind the scenes work or that grunt work.
That's correct.
The practice of law, the lawyers in your firm do.
Correct. In other words, I think practicing law is you get paid directly from, you know, you're playing that game with fee, you're signing pleadings, you are giving legal advice for money, you are showing up in court and lying. I mean, I don't think, and it gets into some real constitutional rights because I think I have a right to make a living and law is all I know.
Who did the fee agreement between your firm and the couple?
Chuck Holbrook did, who's another, by the way, he's an investigator and a paralegal. He's the one that met with them and got the fee agreement signed. So, and by the way,
it wasn't with them and a lawyer.
No. I want to stress this. We found this out. I mean, our office did it and we changed it. We were using fee agreements for a long time that we used in Kentucky that's kind of different. In Kentucky, the lawyer doesn't have to sign it. And we found out that the lawyer has to sign it in Ohio, and we changed that process. Let me give you an example. In Durrani, all 500 Durrani clients actually re-signed a fee agreement to correct that problem. But no, I didn't sign the fee agreement. I don't want to fight with the Ohio Supreme Court about what I can and can't do. I if I'm guilty of anything, I'm guilty of some inadvertence here. I didn't intentionally do anything. And I can't stress this enough. Going forward, I certainly don't want to do anything. I got enough stress. I don't need to be, you know, dealing with this. That's all I have. I won't even reserve any time.
Mr. Caligiuri.
Thank you. May it please the court. Chief Justice O'Connor, distinguished members of this court, Mr. Dieters, I'm Joe Caligiuri and I represent the Office of Disciplinary Counsel. I'd like to respond to a few points that Mr. Dieters made, specifically in response to Justice Bruner's question regarding the advanced contract or the loan that Mr. Dieters advised the Pangallos on. He stated in his statement here today that he used the words, we thought the case was going to settle quickly. We thought it was going to turn around quickly. And I think we need to clarify that. It was the respondent who analyzed the Pangallos case real time in a meeting with just the respondent, his lay investigator, and the Pangallos, and told them, based upon his legal experience, and he admits this, based upon his legal experience, that case would settle within 30 days. And but that Mr. was Calder, the inducement.
How is that problematic? Clarify for me specifically how that is the practice of law, in that without question, it was based on his legal experience, but time as a lawyer. And so go ahead.
Sure, I'm sorry. It constitutes the practice of law because he's doing a real-time analysis based on information that he is receiving from a client as to the value of his case. So he's advising them as to this is how much your case is worth, and this is how long it will take to settle. And they relied on that legal advice for two things. Number one, the context in this case is critical. This was a meeting that was taking place because they had basically terminated the respondent's firm, and they came to this meeting thinking that maybe Mr. Dieters can convince them to stay with this firm. And he has testified that that was the sole purpose of that meeting, was to convince them to remain clients of the firm. So he gave that legal advice and convinced them to stay with the firm because of the rosy outlook that he provided with respect to that case.
But to stay with the firm, not to keep him as their lawyer, because they knew at all times he wasn't a lawyer. Correct.
No, they did not know at all times that he was a lawyer. The only time that they knew he was a lawyer was after the case was over. I'm sorry, after they fired him the second time in April of 2018. There is a line in the board's report that says there was testimony that Jillian Pangallo stated that she was aware that the respondent was not a lawyer. That is inaccurate. She testified unconditionally.
I'm sorry, you said that's inaccurate?
Yes, that is inaccurate. Okay. She testified that at no time between the time they hired Dieters Law until the time they fired them the second time in April of 2018 was she ever aware that he was not a lawyer, and her husband testified to the same thing.
Well, if they thought he was a lawyer and he was acting as a lawyer, why not charge him with that? That would seem much more clear cut.
Because the Pangallos also admitted that the respondent never told them that he was a lawyer. He never said he wasn't a lawyer, but he didn't say he was either. So he didn't exactly hold himself out like we've seen in other cases as being a lawyer, but he never let them know that he wasn't.
I guess, you know, switch gears a little bit. You know, my concern here is you've got this meeting, and when you take everything put together in context, it looks like something a lawyer would do, advising about the value of the claim, how to get a loan, trying to persuade them to stay. But I guess what I'm troubled by is, you know, there's five separate, he was charged with five violations out of this meeting. I think there's three or four that are left. How do you come up with that many different violations? It seems to me that you take the individual things in isolation, saying, for example, advising them how to get a loan, that's probably not the practice of law. Saying what a claim is worth by itself, other people do that besides lawyers. So I guess what I struggle with is, you know, parsing this down to four separate or five separate violations and been saying how each one of them is a violation. So maybe you can address that.
Sure. And I think that's a valid point and a fair point. The Relator Disciplinary Council originally charged this matter as two instances of the unauthorized practice of law, one from the meeting on January 29, 2018, and one from the phone call that the respondent made to Jillian Pangalo the second time they were fired on April 24th, 2018. The UPL panel and the board then separated them into individual instances of the unauthorized practice of law. Relator originally stated that the panel should recommend the imposition of a civil penalty based upon those two incidents taken in conjunction with each other. So, but in reality, whether you slice it up into four different instances of the unauthorized practice of law or one incident of the unauthorized practice of law, I don't think anything changes. He gave legal advice and counsel to clients who were—
Would the amount of fine change? Would that change the amount?
I don't think it changes the amount because the fine is based upon the flagrancy of the violations and the harm that was caused to the Pangalos. And the fact in the second instance, which I'll call the second instance, the board referred to it as the sixth or the fourth instance, was the second time they fired the respondent. He called them, he gave them erroneous legal advice, which essentially what he was doing was interpreting paragraph 9 of the fee agreement, which called for a lien on any future settlement. And the respondent called Jillian Pangalo when he learned that they were firing him for the second time. And he gave erroneous legal advice by stating to her, we're going to take a 33 1/3% lien on top of the lien that the fee that any future lawyer takes in your case.
How is that legal advice? What if the office manager said that? Is that legal? I mean, it may have been erroneous, it may have been incorrect, but to say we're gonna take a percentage, how is that legal advice?
Well, if a paralegal or an office manager would have said, you know, our firm policy is to place a lien on the file, left it at that, that would not be the unauthorized practice of law, but that's not what happened here. What he did was he called this client who wanted to fire the firm, and he gave erroneous advice that lien would be stacked upon another lawyer's lien, which directly influenced her decision on whether or not they could terminate the firm. And so by giving her that advice as to what her rights and responsibilities were under the contract, he was in fact interpreting his own fee agreement and advising her on what her responsibilities were under that contract.
Going back to the value of the case, if I were an accident, my next door neighbor is a claims adjuster for an insurance company, and I describe what happened and the injuries and the damage, and he says, oh, that's at least a $50,000 case. Is that the practice of law?
I don't think so, because it's the context that is critical in this case. Again, this is a former lawyer with over 20 years experience that goes into a meeting in order to convince his clients to refrain from terminating his firm and starts using his legal acumen and skill to analyze in real time the information he's receiving his clients and then spitting out a legal opinion as to the value of their case to convince them to stay with the firm. So when the respondent says, yes.
I apologize for interrupting.
No problem.
You were saying in real time. So if he had met with them, left the room, came back 20 minutes later, and it's not real time, does it matter?
It depends what he did when he left the room. If he left the room and went to talk to an attorney and came back and relayed the information that the attorney gave, no, it wouldn't be a problem. But he chose to go to this meeting without a lawyer present and provided this information, again, real time, while the Pangalos were in this state of whether or not they should pursue litigation with their firm. And so they were looking to make an informed decision, and the respondent, who's, you know, when he had a valid law license, he was unethical. This is someone that we need to protect our Ohio citizens from. He's giving them, yes.
So one thing I'm bothered by, when I asked Mr. Dieters about the loan, he said, what possibly could be a client confidence relayed in a public hearing about why it took longer and went from 3,000 to 10,000, because he said, oh, the client didn't tell me that he had a pre-existing injury. Well, that's, I mean, unless that's in a deposition that's filed someplace in the case, that's relaying a client confidence right there, but yet he's not licensed any longer. But I would think that a paralegal would also be bound by the attorney-client privilege if that's the role he's performing. How do you deal with that?
Well, that's part of the problem. He brought that information up at the UPL hearing as well, that he claimed that Clinton Pangalo had misrepresented things. And before I address your specific point, I just want to say that the fact is that he relied on the information that Clinton Pangalo gave him in that meeting. And he turned around and gave him a legal opinion as to not only the value of the case, but how long it would take for the case to proceed or settle. And then he also advised Clinton to go ahead and sue his employer to add them as a defendant in the case because they had deeper insurance pockets. But getting to your point, that's the problem with allowing people like Mr. Dieters this opportunity that he has to practice law behind the scenes, because with regard to where he stands being a retired lawyer, he, as the board found, he's trying to basically blur the lines between being permitted to practice law based upon the fact that he has all this legal experience, but being insulated from any sort of prosecution for the unauthorized practice of law because he's simply passing along information, as he likes to say. But we can't prosecute him under Gov by Rule 5, the rules of professional conduct, because he no longer has a valid license. So it's a real problem, and that's why we're here.
So where's the line then? Where's the line? This Ohio and the states permit paralegals, research assistants. Where is the line? You're saying he's blurring it. So what line has he blurred?
I think the line that he has blurred is the providing legal advice and counsel. I mean, our court has held that for decades, that the practice, the unauthorized practice of law isn't constrained to appearing in court. It also involves providing legal advice and counsel. And he knows that he's providing legal advice and counsel.
If someone knows he's not a lawyer, but they ask him his advice, is he practicing law?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that, Justice Kennedy?
I'm sorry. If someone knows he is no longer a lawyer, he's retired his license, everybody signs it, they know it, and then they still talk to him, is he practicing law?
Well, if he's giving the same legal opinions and conclusions that he's giving in the case here, yes. This court has held.
So if he's a paralegal and you walk into his office and you're talking with the paralegal, you know that individual is a paralegal, you ask them a question and they say X, Y, and Z in response. You are saying to me that that's the practice of law.
Well, if we take your example and plug in some of the facts from this case, if you walk into a paralegal's office and they say, you know, you need to sue your employer because they have deeper insurance pockets, and the client insists that I don't want to do that, and you insist and say you must sue them, you must add them as a client, and if you don't, you're stupid. That is the practice of law, the unauthorized.
So part. If you go to family dinner and you ask your cousin those same questions and they give you those same answers, is that the unauthorized practice of law?
I don't believe so, no.
Why?
Because the
context. You know that every single one of those individuals in that same scenario are not a lawyer.
Right, but that's why, in my opinion, this court has, like Mr. Dieters is requesting, we need a list of what is and what isn't. And I don't think that's appropriate, because every case is evaluated on its own merits and on its own facts. And there's discretion involved in the prosecution of these cases. And that's an example of something that we would not consider to be the unauthorized practice of law. The difference here is that the respondent was in the situation or in the context of providing legal advice to clients who wanted to terminate his firm. And that's what makes this, the context coupled with his actions, constitute the unauthorized practice of law.
Counsel, so what if he was on, What if he was just on the street corner and somebody asked him, is that the practice of law? I'm really trying to discern from you. Are we really talking about time, temporal? Are we talking about a location or the trappings of it? Because in all of those scenarios, whether it's him, whether it's the paralegal, or whether it's your cousin, everybody knows they're not a lawyer, but yet there's a different answer of whether they're practicing law. So I'm trying to understand exactly what it is.
Well, as the dissent in the Watkins case stated, we don't, lawyers don't have a monopoly on the practice of law, so to speak. There's all sorts of lay individuals that might give a legal opinion here and there. So that's why I think it's so critical that the context of this case is taken into context when deciding it, because when someone approaches someone of Mr. Dieter's stature and reputation and history, they're expecting him to provide them with advice. He is really on it, has a duty to let people know that he's not permitted to give that advice. And he actually has to function as a paralegal and get permission and supervision from lawyers in his office. And while he states that he was passing along information, it's just not accurate. The lawyer that was working on their case had been admitted 27 days in Kentucky, not even in Ohio. It's just unrealistic to believe that Mr. Dieters was getting advice from him on what to tell the Pangalos.
Counsel, I have a question about the initial advice. Was this was going to settle rather quickly, 30 days, it's going to be worth X amount of dollars, et cetera. Did that influence the couple to take out this loan for $3,000, thinking that it's going to be a quick turnaround, and then, weeks and months pass and $3,000 with interest turns into $10,000. That is something we should focus on as a damage to a couple, to this client. I'd comment on that, please.
You're absolutely right, Chief Justice. Mr. Dieter's representations, his analysis, his legal advice as to how quickly that case would settle induced them into taking that loan, and they testified to that. They stated that they relied on his advice that the case would settle within 30 days in taking that loan. Yes, they were in a desperate financial situation, but the respondent really took advantage of that. In fact, on page 85 of the transcript, he states, they came to my office, I explained to them the intricacies of this loan, which I agree with Justice DeWine, that in itself isn't practicing law. But when you tie the time that a case is going to settle to an advanced civil litigation contract, which is governed by statute or requires the involvement of a lawyer, that is the practice of law. But what he said was the Pangalos were so desperate for the deal that they took it. And I asked him on cross-examination, I said, and they relied on your legal advice in taking that deal. And he said, absolutely.
Well, they did not know that he was not a lawyer. That's what their testimony is. And the mistake is what is contained in our written documents, correct?
Yes. In the UPL board's report on... on page 10, there's a statement that says Jillian admitted in her testimony that she was aware that he was not licensed to practice law. And that is not accurate. I've scoured the transcript. She stated repeatedly that she didn't know. And the way she found out was after April 24th, 2018, she was with her father and was telling him what happened. And he said, well, that guy's not even a lawyer. And that was the first time she realized that he wasn't an attorney.
So did you file an objection? Do we have an objection before us from your office regarding a factual discrepancy?
No, Your Honor, but under this court's authority, you have the authority to go back into the record and find that was an inaccurate finding.
Is there any evidence that Mr. Dieters or his firm benefited from their making that loan? I thought there was evidence that, they were, the couple were in financial straits and needed money, even if believing that there would be a settlement soon. But is there any evidence that Mr. Dieters benefited from that loan money?
There is not, no.
And is it true, I think as Mr. Dieters stated earlier, that even if they thought this would settle quickly, there ended up being some information non-disclosed about a prior injury, which delayed this. So that unknown factor created the time delay.
Well, that's if you believe what Mr. Dieters said. The Pangalas would dispute that there. That was an issue about whether or not he had a pre-existing injury. According to the testimony, Mr. Pangalo had a pre-existing knee injury, but it was on the other leg. So there was no misrepresentation, but Mr. Dieters characterized it as a misrepresentation. But the important point, I think, that shows the advice and counsel was that during that meeting, he was soliciting this information for them to provide them with the legal advice and counsel on what they should do with their case. And that's where he crosses the line into engaging in the unauthorized practice of law.
I don't know the answer to this question or necessarily if it's relevant to this matter, disciplinary matter, or this UPL matter, but could Mr. Dieters' law firm be liable for malpractice of any kind as a result of Mr. Dieters' conduct, even though he's not a lawyer?
Well, I suppose that whoever was representing the Pangalas in this case would be could be held liable in a legal malpractice case. I'm not sure it would meet all the elements, but in that sense, I think the firm itself could be held liable if there was a legal malpractice claim.
Okay.
So, counsel, he never told them he wasn't a lawyer. Now, admittedly, he never told he was, but the sign on the door says Dieters Law Firm. He, in testimony, made the statement that he is a litigator.
He did.
All right. In what context was that made?
I think what he was saying in that particular context to the panel was that there was some question, if I remember correctly, there was some question about a deposition transcript and how things can be taken out of context. And he said, you know, I'm a litigator. I understand that things in depositions could get taken out of context or something like that. He wasn't saying to the panel, I'm a litigator right now, but that statement that he used, I'm a litigator, stuck with the panel because they were concerned that the respondent simply has not been able to walk away from the mindset of the bulldog, of the litigator, of the fixer in the firm. He continues to carry that on a daily basis. So we need to be concerned about not only what he says publicly, but what's happening behind closed doors. Again, he chose to go to this meeting without a lawyer. That should tell us something.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Dieters, you declined to reserve any time for response. Would you like to take some time?
On a few key points. The record is very clear that I repeatedly told them who their lawyer was, and they would say, who's our lawyer now? They acknowledged that I was not their lawyer.
Okay, and there were lawyers. Did they ever meet with a lawyer?
Yes.
Who?
They met with Dominic Romeo, and I don't remember if they ever met with Fred Johnson and Ben Moran,
according to the testimony, they didn't know who these people were.
They were told by emails who they were. There's emails in this record that says, your lawyer is Fred Johnson. Your lawyer is Ben Moran. They are licensed Ohio lawyers working on the case that is in the record of this case.
They never corresponded with these lawyers.
These lawyers did copy them on correspondence. These lawyers in the record are letters from Fred Johnson and Ben Moran and Dominic Romeo being sent to insurance companies, all the correspondence. I didn't sign one thing. In addition to this, This is very important. Mona says what he's accused. Mona Eldridge, who's our car wreck paralegal here, she says all the time, every single thing that Mr. Caligari has a problem with me saying. She says it all day long, and I'm just warning this court, you're opening up a Pandora's box for paralegals across the state of Ohio and across the country, because all day long, paralegals are telling clients on behalf of their lawyers what goes on. And I take great offense what he said about me being an unethical lawyer. I had absolutely not one single Ohio charge against me when I retired from my Ohio license. I'm in the process of being reinstated in Kentucky. I take great offense to that shot that he took at me. And ever since this Pangallo situation, I can assure you, we've upped the precautions that we take around here relative to me. I am right next door to Alex Battaglia, Jim Moss, two Ohio licensed lawyers who are working every single day in the Durrani litigation. I mean, I don't practice law. What I'm accused of doing here, paralegals do all day long across this state. That's all I got.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you adjourn court?
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.